My name is Larry Rasmussen. My normal employment is as a teacher of social ethics at a Methodist seminary in Washington, D.C. But last summer and this summer, it's been our joy to be at Holden Village for the summer. And while my normal task here is not that of teaching, I do that once in a while and begin today the first of three sessions at this hour, today through Wednesday, on the moral dimension of the abortion issue. There are two clusters of moral issues, I think, in the whole abortion debate. And I welcome our discussion over the next 3 days of those moral dimensions of this issue. One cluster is around abortion and the question of whether or not, or under what circumstances, it might be the taking of human life. The second cluster is around the relationship of a moral judgment on abortion to the law of the land. That is to say, the relationship in general of morality and law. It isn't obvious, anyway, that once you have arrived at a moral decision on an issue, this or any other, that you automatically have the way in which that should be made a public policy. There is a whole lot that needs to be talked about in the relationship between morality and law. So two clusters of issue, abortion and the taking of life, and abortion and public policy, no matter what your stand is on the first. Today, I would like it if we could get through a couple of four elements that will be a part of our discussion over 3 days. Just some factual matters. What is the situation? And I'm going to confine it to the United States. We may together broaden it beyond that. What is the situation with respect to the use of abortion? And some other elements on factual matters. What are distinctions that are made among abortions? That's a factual matter. Then I would like for us to also talk today about theological perspectives on our discussing abortion. And then I would imagine tomorrow's session to focus in on moral norms as such and the question of abortion as the taking of life, and Wednesday's session to focus in on the cluster of issues around the law, abortion and the law. Part of that question of the law will come up in this very first session because we want to talk about the current discussions in this country as they are taking shape these days on Capitol Hill. I see lots of old friends back that I haven't had a chance to greet yet. If you've been to Holden before, you know that the sessions are to be conversations and not simply presentations. So I welcome your comments. If you have been around the Holden a while, you know that a session doesn't quit when the bell does. It goes on. I like to say that at best, a session at Holden concludes with a semicolon and never with a period. So your comments are solicited along the way. My procedure will be as follows. I want to focus on how one might think through the issue. I will use some of my own reflections upon the abortion issue to do that, but that is intended to be a kind of foil for you. The purpose of the session is for you to think through this question. I see my task as a sometime teacher of ethics to try to facilitate your moral deliberation of the issue. I'm going to do that, as I said, by way of reflecting my own thinking on it, but it will be my thinking in the form of lifting up the elements that ought to go into moral deliberation of abortion. I don't like to do this topic. I get a headache when I talk about abortion for 3 hours. But I get so irritated, it's a matter of passion with me after a while, at the outrageous kinds of argumentation that go on all sides of the issue. And I just say, wait a minute, stop. There's something else to be considered. Or are you consistent here? Or have you taken that into account? Or how does that relate to your stand on this other issue? So that whole procedure of proper moral deliberation, of decent thinking through of an issue that has moral dimensions, that's the purpose of these sessions. And my hope is that your own stand on the matter is further clarified for yourself, and insofar as it also contributes to the others, for all of us. There is a long tradition of deliberation about the ethical dimensions of any issues, and I want to try to lift up from my side some of the elements of good moral deliberation. I want then us to listen to you to listen to your own view anew, and I want us to listen to each other's view. Let's move right to the context of the current debate. There are some factors here that I want to put before us just so we're all on board as to the situation presently in the United States. I welcome your additions to this brief sketch. One, the frequency of abortions in the United States. The most recent figures I have that are official are from 1978, which is, as you know, a little ways back now, from the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. What these figures represent are known legal abortions. That means, of course, that there are then more abortions than this number. These are the reported abortions done under legal auspices. In 1978, and the figure I've put on the board here, there were 1,157,776 legal abortions reported in the United States. This was an increase of about 7% over 1977, which when the number was about 1 million. It was 1,079,000. And this represents a trend. There has been about a 7% trend over the last few years in the number of reported legal abortions. What that comes out to, compared with live births, is one abortion for every three live births in the United States. One for three. Now, the most general picture is that the majority of abortions were obtained by white women under 25, unmarried, and who had not yet given birth. The figures run this way, and this is again for 1978 from the Center for Disease Control. 67% of the women who obtained legal abortions were white, 65% were under 25 years of age, 74% were unmarried, 57% had not given live birth before. Or, if you want to just say it differently, 33% were non-white, 35% were over 25, 26% of the persons who had legal abortions were married, and 43% were mothers of at least one child. It's just the other side of those figures. Now, the legal standing. The present debate at the public policy level, that is to say primarily in Washington, D.C. now, revolves around the conflict over the Supreme Court decision of 8 years ago. That Supreme Court decision was the case of Roe versus Wade. Ever since that decision was rendered, There has been a movement to place into law a policy regulating abortion. The conflict there centers on the legal meaning of person in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Prior to the present proposed laws, the abortion, any laws that have had to do with abortion have not said anything about the legal standing of the fetus. That is what is different in the present proposed law and constitutional amendment from the older laws. The current court, the Burger Court, in Roe versus Wade, ruled that the fetus is not, at all stages of development, a legal person. That is to say, the fetus is not entitled to protection under law. Roe versus Wade said that in the first trimester of pregnancy, abortion is strictly a matter between a woman and her physician. No questions asked, no conditions needed to pertain to make her the woman eligible, so to speak, for abortion. The second trimester, Roe versus Wade said there were some qualifying conditions that had to do with the health, or the factors of the pregnant woman's health and the things that had to do with making abortion safe, so that there was not medical danger involved. Roe versus Wade said that in the third trimester, or more precisely, after the point had been reached where the fetus was viable, could live outside the mother's womb, then the only legal abortions would be those where the mother's health was in serious jeopardy. So first trimester, no conditions, no questions asked. Second trimester, some conditions that pertain to health, the woman's health and medical safety, and the third trimester, the only legal abortions were when the mother's health was seriously jeopardized by continuing to carry the fetus. In Congress presently, there are two major movements to overturn or to do an end run around the Supreme Court decision. One is a constitutional amendment proposed by Representative Dornan of California that declares that human life is deemed to exist from the moment of fertilization, and that thus the fetus at all stages is protected as a person under law. It's crucial that we've got that clear. The fetus from the moment of conception is a person in the legal sense and is protected by law. The only justifiable abortion under Dornan's proposed amendment is when the life of the mother is clearly in the balance, if she would continue her pregnancy. But the constitutional amendment requires ratification of 3/4 of the states, and there are a lot of people on the Hill who think that it does not stand a good chance of getting that kind of ratification. And so a civil statute is now presently in Congress, introduced by Representative Hyde and Senator Helms, that would legislatively circumvent the Supreme Court decision. And I'll give you the exact wording of Senate Bill 158. Quote, "Human life shall be deemed to exist from the point of conception without regard to race, age, health, defect, or condition of dependency." Human life is deemed to exist from the point of conception without regard to race, age, health, defect, or condition of dependency, end of quote. It further says that for the purposes of due process and equal protection, those guarantees under the 14th Amendment, the word person applies to all human life. So it has the same
effect as a constitutional amendment, namely that the fetus at all stages, from the point of conception on, is deemed a human person under the law. We won't spend much time with this. Presently, there's a raging debate in Washington about the constitutionality of that proposed law, because it, in effect, so the opponents say, removes the abortion question from the kind of thing that the Supreme Court can rule on at all. In other words, this law says this law will not be subject to review by the Supreme Court. So there's a big controversy about the constitutionality of the law. And I just put you on notice there because that's a part of the hearings and is a part of the news when this comes up. It is clearly the case that if either of these is successful, the constitutional amendment or the proposed civil statute, states would then be free to legislate on abortion as murder. Do we have questions or comments that you want to raise at this point about just the present debate on the Hill?
Is there any other precedent like this in other laws for kind of defining what certain things mean in the Constitution?
I don't know. Paul, do you know, perchance?
There's a debate about that.
Yeah.
As I understand it, the constitutional scholars just have to show finally their normative legal color on that matter. Some would say that judicial supremacy gives to the court the final power to define the terms of the Constitution, regardless of what Congress should explicitly pass, unless they pass it. Then furthermore, even if you say that the court, regardless of what you say on that, there's the question of whether or not the court did speak to the issue of the definition by even a relatively late decision. So I think interpreters of that decision say all the court said is we don't know what to define.
Yeah.
Other interpreters say what it said is we're not wise enough to say finally plan human life begins, but for legal purposes we will define human life as not starting at conception.
Yeah.
And there's a debate between interpreters there.
Yeah. It should be pointed out in addition that the real basis for the Roe versus Wade decision, the decision was rendered on the basis of a woman's right to privacy.
Ah, mm-hmm. There's a dispute about that. Whether that's the only major some analysts, I think I would side with them, would say that it takes two principles to generate their conclusion. One, the woman's privacy, and number two, the claim that we don't know clearly what the status of the fetus is. Because if we did know clearly what the status of the fetus was, or acknowledge that as a possibility, then, even if we did say, cite the woman's right to privacy, when would privacy of the mother figure out right?
That's a good point. It would be the two together. Yes?
Wouldn't the issue of all life begins with conception, and that supposing a Lutheran female has a spontaneous abortion, or if you call it a miscarriage, at 3 months, would not then that mandate that we need to make the practice of carrying out a burial for that child?
You anticipate one of the elements that I was going to include later on how we respond to natural abortions and what that says about how we in fact view this. That is to say, as you've implicated, if we regard this as a human being, why is there not then such things as a burial service in the event of a miscarriage? Or do we in fact regard this as a form of human life but not yet a person? It's a different issue from the legal one, which asks about, which is saying that in the legal sense, this is the life of a person.
Isn't there also the little personal defense in human that further established or that set up the viability?
Well,
in a car accident, lost a few in our case, and the fetus was not viable outside the mother's womb.
Yeah. We'll get to that as well. There are different demarcations about when human life sets in, if you will. And that's been one of them that's been offered. There are different traditions on that that we'll get to. I want to be... Yes?
You were talking about the number of abortions. We hear often that since the Supreme Court decision that they've been just an outrageous amount. Like you said, what the figures that people are going on are the reported, is that right? So that really doesn't take into account how many numerous ones that we don't know about that were not legal and therefore not...
Yes, reported. Yeah.
So it may not necessarily, just for the sake of discussion, it may not necessarily be totally true that abortions are indeed on the increase except for the fact that they're legal.
Yes, that's a good point. That's a good point. The figures that I cited and the percentage increase over the last few years was percentage increase on reported legal abortions. Yeah.
Well, to carry that further, is that, carry what you were talking about earlier, for your state might have to decide whether something is murder or not. It seems like, how in the world would every single miscarriage have to be investigated then? You know,
that is an objection that is raised by many people. How is this law enforced if it is passed? What does it mean? Ellen Goodman writes frequently in the Boston Globe and Washington Post about whether or not we're getting government off our backs if you pass such a law as this because of the difficulties of enforcing.
Doesn't it make some forms of birth control illegal then, like an IUD?
Yes, and unless things are qualified here, an IUD, which prevents implantation of a fertilized egg, then becomes a subject of considerable debate because you've said that human life begins at the point of fertilization and not implantation. Let me go to some distinctions among abortions and distinctions among circumstances around abortion, still offering empirical factors, some factual matters that become important to our debate. Some abortions are sought in view of the state of the fetus. Sometimes normal fetuses are aborted, and reasons for abortion are those which reside with the mother and or others. Situations where you're not asking about the fetus's condition. But lots of times, abortions are sought because of the state of the fetus. Where there's an abnormal fetus or an expected abnormal future for the child. So, for example, one might seek abortions because of genetic deformities. I'll read you the situation with a couple, the Edwards of Virginia Beach, Donna and Denny Edwards. He was in the Navy, and when he was in the Navy, they were denied an abortion by, and I'm quoting now, restrictive language in the Defense Department budget, where they could not use government monies designated for the military to be spent for an abortion. Their fetus was anencephalic. That is to say, it was a fetus that was developing without a brain. It would, at the time of birth, be stillborn. they knew that it was a fetus developing without a brain and that it would be stillborn, so they sought funds from the military to perform the abortion. And she said that she simply did not want to live with the trauma of carrying a child who would be stillborn and without a brain. Well, that's an example of abnormal development of the fetus as the reason for seeking an abortion. Some people, through the process of amniocentesis, discover that the fetus has Down syndrome, commonly called mongolism, which we shouldn't use. It's a terrible slur on a people. But Down syndrome, or double chromosome or something, in other words, genetic deformity is a reason. Sometimes abortions are sought because of an expected abnormal future for the child, such as the case of genetically inherited diseases. I don't know if you know about Tay-Sachs disease, but that is an example of a disease where you can find, while the fetus is still developing, whether or not, you know whether what kind of chances there are that the child will have Tay-Sachs, because if you can tell whether the parents are carriers. If they are, there's one in four chance that the child will develop Tay-Sachs. And Tay-Sachs is really a heartbreaking genetic horror. It is a certainty that the child will die in a very cruel death after a period of terrible suffering, and that death will occur within about 3 or 4 years at the most. So sometimes abortions are sought because of a genetically inherited disease, even though the fetus develops normally. Sometimes the situation does not rest with the state of the fetus, but with reasons that reside with the pregnant woman and or others significant for her. Cases of unwanted children, and there would be many reasons for that. I'll tell you about a case of a friend of ours, and we had long discussions about abortion. In her case, it was a matter of she would like children, but not now. Happened to be busily engaged in a career, didn't expect to get pregnant, didn't want to get pregnant, did get pregnant. Teenage pregnancies might be another example of a quite different sort, a case of rape or a case of incest, or that is violation by others. You do not want the child of this particular relationship. It doesn't rest with the fetus's condition, but with the condition and the circumstances of the mother. Or poverty. Children may be wanted, but abortion is acquired out of the conviction that more family cannot properly be cared for. So those are just some different reasons. You might want to offer further reasons. I just put those out there because of a conviction that in the present abortion debate, very frequently the debate is carried out with people without people asking whether there are significant differences among abortions and the reasons for abortions. When I hear from the people who are strongly pro-life, and that too is categorizing, the conversation, I listen carefully to the conversation. The conversation is always with the assumption that you're talking about the normal development of a normal fetus, and the picture is of a healthy, bouncy baby who will be the joy of their life. I mean, that's the picture that's projected, as if there weren't significant differences among abortions. Oftentimes when I hear some of the debates and arguments from the so-called pro-choice, the picture one sees is something like every conception is a violation of some relationship. You know, it's in the outcome of something, some relationship of violation. So I do this because I think there are, in fact, a lot of different reasons, and it may be morally significant to distinguish among abortions. It's certainly different In the case of the fetus that's anencephalic, to be stillborn, not to have a brain assured of death, that's certainly different than the case of our friend for whom it was essentially inconvenience.
I've also observed that often the baby is carried on without mention of the word mother.
Mm.
Especially, well, more in the pro-life and the pro-choice group, as though there's always the insistence that the word baby be used rather than fetus.
Yes.
Or embryo, so that carries the connotation of a live baby. But rarely do you hear the word mother.
Mm.
So the baby exists in a bottle or a womb outside of a person.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. The language is extremely important. I mean, we just need to watch our language here because it tells very much what words are used, what words are not used. Yeah. Likewise, and this is sort of carrying it on, one hears the contention, and it may be the case, but I want to say that it should matter about which it may matter. What may matter may be a distinction among abortions, a contention that abortion is murder. Well, are you ready to say that it would be murder in the instance of that anencephalic child? I mean, if you generalize totally and just say abortion is murder, then you mean presumably for all cases of abortion. If it isn't murder in the case, in that particular case, why isn't it murder in that particular case? That's the kind of questions that moral deliberation would push. What would make it murder, if you said it isn't, if you contended it wasn't murder, why wouldn't it be murder? And then you might end up making some distinctions about abortion, and just as important, you might end up probing our moral foundations. In this case, exactly what is meant by murder. Okay, let's go to some of the theological factors. I'd like to at least have those in front of us so that tomorrow when we start talking about abortion and the taking of human life, we can work with a kind of framework that comes out of our contention that this is a serious matter for Christians to debate, and that we ought to be as self-conscious about the theological claims as we are informed about the empirical or the factual matters. I will mention some. You may want to add other theological claims. I would say that if our debate, as Christians anyway, would at least include the contention that life is a gift of God. We wouldn't want to debate abortion without being self-conscious about that claim. All life is a gift of God, human and non-human, actual and potential. Life, we say, is a great and an awesome and a good thing. It's also finite. Death is also a part of life for all creatures. Part of human life as a gift of God is, we would say, and it's a kind of second theological claim, that we are born with a sort of restless creative freedom. Human creativity is part of God's creation, is our contention. God is present through the processes of nature outside us, but God is also present through human creativity as part of nature or creation in a much larger sense. That doesn't tell us now anything about the specifics of human intervention. It doesn't tell us whether we should experiment with DNA or we should pursue further genetic research and pursue genetic manipulation, whether we should develop further testings of the conditions of the fetus as we already have with amniocentesis. Doesn't answer that. It does say that somehow or another it's significant that part of our nature as human beings is that of being creative and free creatures. Should we develop further technologies that keep marginal preemies alive only by those technologies would be an important question to our debate. somehow the bearing of who we are as human beings comes into a discussion there. We do claim that part of the image of God, our creation in the image of God, is the reality of human creativity and human freedom, or, differently said, human power to alter our own environment and even our own bodies. Even when we say that, theological claim doesn't make those hard moral choices about what in fact we ought to do or refrain from doing. I mention this because many of the abortion cases today are just that, abortion cases, because of the fruits of human creativity. The Tay-Sachs case, genetic diseases. We wouldn't know about them if it hadn't been for those developments that reside in our human powers. Or a safe abortion itself is a matter of human creativity. So, first then, life is a gift from God. Secondly, human life includes a freedom and a creativity and power. Third, that life is a good gift from God means that it has a derivative dignity and respect for life, for human life. Whatever I do, I should not willfully violate human life. It is good. It is created good. It is good in the eyes of God. Whatever I do, I should exercise compassion. Whatever I do, I should value this precious gift. Have an awesome respect for life. Again, to make a theological claim for dignity does not as such make the hard moral decisions for us. It does place them in a context for deliberation. It sets our deliberation about abortion within a particular framework. We ought not to discuss these questions apart from a deepened respect for the awesomeness of the good gift of life. In fact, I will contend that's what a theological framework does, primarily, is set a context for our decisions, rather than a one-to-one relationship between a theological claim and a specific moral choice. Take the reality of suffering and death. To respect dignity means, for example, working to alleviate suffering and to promote healing. To respect dignity means to work to postpone death. If I simply stood by and watched the victim of an accident, a car accident, suffer, both that victim's humanity and my own humanity would be diminished, because I have not respected an innate goodness. I have not accorded that life a dignity as God-given. Someone would rightly call my failure to respond to that suffering accidents victim inhumane. On another level, dignity means accepting our creatureliness, living with our finitude, even accepting the inevitable, namely death. So postponing death is one expression of dignity, and learning how to die and how to accept the death of others is another expression of dignity and respect. Alleviating suffering is one expression of dignity, learning how to suffer and enhancing humanity in the midst of suffering is another, because it is inevitable, as death is inevitable. Why mention this for abortion? Because there are often very cruel choices in life. Is the dignity of the fetus and the dignity of the parents and the dignity of the medical personnel attending the case violated or respected in the case of the Tay-Sachs child? Or the anencephalic fetus and the parents? Or the fetus and the pregnant but poverty-stricken villager? Is the dignity violated or respected? So dignity of life is a claim upon us. It makes for hard choices, but I shudder to remember the moments in history when it's been lost. And I think that in Christian context, that has to be a part of any consideration of abortion. It doesn't get rid of the hard choices and the actual conflicts, but it means that we can't carry on the debate without respecting the dignity of all of the parties involved. And then I'm going to just list one more theological claim, and then we can fill it out in the time that's left. Our contention is that God is seen with most compelling clarity in Jesus of Nazareth. And seen there, there is a special weight of compassion and concern which is tilted towards those who are the defenseless, those who are the mute, those who are the ill, those who are the weak. I would say that justice, in biblical terms, is the rendering of whatever is required for the flourishing of creation. Justice is the rendering of whatever is required for the flourishing of creation, but much of creation cannot attain to its own due, its own flourishing, by itself. And the contention is that God tilts with special compassion towards those who cannot attain to their own flourishing by themselves. So should we, as stewards of life, bend in that direction? An unborn fetus, a severely handicapped person, a tree, other elements of non-human life, exploitable resources, future generations that don't have a vote yet with us. These are all vital in creation, but they can't always attain their own due. And the theological claim is that they have a claim upon us for that due. Now, what do these theological claims mean for deliberating abortion? Life is a good gift of God. There's a freedom and a dignity in human life, and there are special claims of the weak and the mute upon us. If this were a class in ethics, this is starting to sound like all as I talk more and you talk less. I would, at this point, play some tapes of church conventions whether they were debating the abortion issue on the floor. And then we would just listen for instances of fallacious reasoning. The most common ones that I come up against are, one, to argue that there is a one-to-one relationship between a theological conviction and a moral conclusion. So the delegate says something like this: if we really believe that God is love, then we must be against all abortions. One-to-one, a theological contention of a very broad sort, God is love, and a specific moral conclusion drawn from that. Or, from another point of view, if we really believe in the dignity of human beings, then we must allow the woman to choose to have an abortion or not. That's an argument from a very broad claim to a very specific moral conclusion. And my contention is that that is fallacious reasoning. You can take the same broad claim and come to many different moral conclusions, because there are other elements that play into it, not least of which are other facts of what people are assuming as other factual situations. Also, there are some moral norms that enter in, and a couple of moral norms which are different, may relate to the same general contention, God is love. Or, just to say that it's rarely sound reasoning to move in a straight line from a theological claim to a moral choice. Another common error is really just a version of the first one. It's to cite scripture and use it in that fashion. Sometimes on theological grounds, sometimes on moral grounds. So a delegate on the floor says, the Bible is against abortion. Therefore, we should be. Or more specifically, the Bible says, thou shalt not kill, and abortion is killing, the matter is clear. That's another example of fallacious reasoning. He doesn't quite even notice that even if you were going to contend that the Bible says that. The Bible says all kinds of things about killing, and it's not altogether clear, at least without further debate, what the more specific stand might be. A too simplistic relating of biblical material to specific modern moral choices. Well, what then do the theological claims add up to for our talking as Christians about abortion? I think at least this: a framework, a context, a general orientation, a general positioning of our views for making and then living with difficult moral choices. I would argue the faith tradition means something like this. I think it's correct to say that it would establish a strong burden of proof. Just as we wouldn't say that violent means and nonviolent means are equal choices, but that the weight is always tilted in favor of nonviolence over violence, so I think it would be proper to say that in choices of abortion or carrying the fetus to term, they are not equal choices on the same level. The assumption is that that all else being equal, the fetus ought to be carried to term. If there is an exception to that, it's an exception which must meet a burden of proof. Is that clear how we had a tilt in deliberation from the theological claim? It must be especially strong justification because the assumption favors carrying the fetus to term over aborting the fetus. There may be exceptions, but they need to be regarded as exceptions which require special moral justification. And I think the general theological claims render that posture. You can add to that with a note from the tradition of moral reasoning. One of the teachings is that if you agree on the ruling moral norm, the standards by which you're going to choose what is right and what is wrong, if you agree on those and their grounds, then the case for any exceptions has to be made by appealing to the same norms that establish the rule. You can't use one set of norms to establish the rule on moral choices and then go to another set of norms and reasons for establishing the exception. For example, if I said that I think there are some justifiable abortions, I would be committed to make my case for those exceptions by appealing to the same theological grounds that I said established the reason for carrying the fetus to term. I would say something like, in the tragic situation of the Tay-Sachs fetus, it is respect for life, the dignity of life, the goodness of life in God, and in this case, it means an early abortion as a lesser evil than a terrible suffering death of the child and the agony of parents and medical personnel. I must use the respect, the dignity, the goodness of life, those same things for establishing my reason for an abortion as I did for establishing the basic posture. You may or may not agree with my decision on that particular case, but I just wanted to make this point about proper procedure, namely that cases for exceptions to abortions need to be justified on the same grounds as those that give you the rule in the first place. Well, let me quit there and ask, as preparation for our session tomorrow on the moral questions around the taking of life, whether you have things that you want to add about the general theological claims, whether you want to add others to that, whether you want to talk about the place of our faith stance in our decision-making on moral issues.